If you want access to bonus episodes, reading lists for every series of Empire, a chat community, discounts for all the books mentioned in the week's podcast, ad-free listening, and a weekly newsletter, sign up to Empire Club at www.empirepoduk.com.
Aber was ich noch erzählen wollte, meine Nichte kämpft sich ja ganz schön das Studium. Semesterbeitrag, Laptop, Bücher, Software, Handy, Internet. Ey, so ein Master ist echt teuer.
Ach, sag ihr, sie kann sich das zurückholen.
Ja, du meinst von der Steuer absetzen, ne? Aber sie verdient ja nicht.
Egal, Zauberwort Verlustvortrag. Macht sie ganz einfach mit Wieso Steuer. Und wenn sie dann arbeitet, heißt es Katsching.
Das geht?
Safe, Wieso Steuer.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück.
Jetzt kostenlos ausprobieren.
10.
Abbruch, Abbruch! Was ist los?
Hab Nutella vergessen!
Nicht so ernst.
Schmeckte schon himmlisch, bevor wir auf dem Mond waren. Nur Nutella ist Nutella.
Hello and welcome to the brand new series of Empire with me, Anita Arnon.
And me, William Dalrymple.
It's very exciting, this. Very, very exciting. We've been looking forward to doing this. So, look, Russia, in this particular episode, let me just give you a little menu of what's going to come up, because we're going to be talking about the founding of Russia, the first czars. You'll hear about Mongol hordes, and we have the very best guest to talk to today. It is a strange thing because I've always sort of in my head called him Simon, as in the great Simon Sebag Montefiore, author of The World, A Family History of Humanity. It's an amazing, dazzling, huge tome of a book where you'll find many of the characters that we've discussed throughout this podcast series and so many more besides.
And the Romanovs, the Romanovs.
And the Romanovs. And, you know, and we'll talk about many others of his books because he's got a great back catalogue. But you prefer to be called Sebag. That's right, isn't it?
Well, everyone calls me Sebag except my parents and my brothers.
Yes. Well, I remember when we first met, I called you Simon and you sort of did a little...
Wince.
That's...
We should fess up that Sebag and I have known each other for close on 35 years now, and he was always Sebag when I first knew him.
Yeah. I actually never liked the name Simon. But the Russian Simeon would be better, so you could try that, or Senka for short.
Yeah, not doing that. Sebag is.
Let's stick to Sebag then.
Okay, Sebag it is. Okay. Anyway, look, I want to know, because you have spent so much of your life thinking about, researching and writing about Russia, where the fascination began for you.
I think it began because my mother's family were Jewish refugees from the Russian Empire, from Poland, from Lithuania, and from Odessa, various of them. When I was in my childhood, I was fascinated with these stories, and I began to study it. And I dreamed that one day I would either, you know, be in Russia or write about people like Stalin and Catherine the Great. And then you know, at university, I did Catherine the Great, you know, Enlightened Despots. And then when the war started at the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, I went out there and I was, you know, I was very lucky to witness many of the wars and to be literally lying in a ditch, seeing coups, wars, battles taking place, and to know many of the presidents and warlords of that time.
I remember reading your reports hugely enviously. You were right at the centre of things. And it was
very exciting because, I mean, I think there's a great I think there's no better training for a historian than to witness the fall of a great empire. And that was what we saw. But of course, what we didn't realize was the wars that I was covering, like in Tbilisi, in Abkhazia, in Karabakh, in Chechnya, in Grozny. I mean, they were pretty serious wars. And if you were in them, they were pretty terrifying, but they were nothing compared to what's happening in Ukraine. And of course, we thought that the end of the Soviet Union had been sort of semi-bloodless with these minor wars. But now, of course, we realize it went on for another 20 years and it's still going on.
There was a nice article by Timothy Garton Ash in the Financial Times this weekend that made the prediction that the continuing fall of the Soviet Union is likely to be the major political event in Europe for the next 40 years, he said.
Well, it may well be. I mean, Russia is a very complicated empire. I mean, there are various interesting things. And of course, you know, the Ukraine war makes our conversation terribly important and interesting and relevant. And Sergei Lavrov, when he was the foreign minister, when he was asked who'd advised Putin to invade Ukraine said, you know, he only had three advisors, Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, and Catherine the Great.
I have to issue a correction at this point. I'm not often wrong, but I was wrong in the last episode because I was on a school trip to Russia, but not when you were lying in a ditch in 1991. I got my days and dates in a muddle. It was 89 that I was there, which I did say the date, but I thought it was, I don't know, I got the Yeltsin on a tank thing and in a right old mess. And also the shops I talked about, I said they were the gum stores where foreigners could only go and buy nice things and everyone would want to trade with you. They weren't. They were the Beryushkas.
The Beryushkas. And the gum,
the department store where everyone could go to, but it was Beryushka. So yes, I got my memories in a bit of a mess.
And I was standing next to those tanks that Yeltsin
when I was nowhere near them. It had been 2 years before.
So I think that this discussion is very important, and it is fascinating that the phenomenon that, you know, we've all been fascinated with, say, the British Empire and its achievements and crimes. And in fact, there was a very real empire standing right there in Europe. And when I wrote at the end of the Romanovs, you know, that, you know, the empire continues. Mm. Everyone said to me when I wrote the Romanovs, which was sort of 8 years ago, lots of people said to me, you totally exaggerated that. How could you do that? You're just trying to promote your book and the importance of the Romanovs.
Yeah, who's laughing now? AC Bag, who's laughing now? Yeah.
And it's just interesting how things turn out. So empire is very relevant, and the real empire was staring us right in the face.
Seabag, in our last series, we dealt very briefly with the kind of distant myths of Russian history when we were dealing with Kat Jarman talking about the Rus and the Vikings coming down on those rivers from the Baltic to the Black Sea, founding slaving settlements and slave pens in what's now Ukraine and Russia. But we've left it there. So could you open today by maybe giving us a picture of what happens next in Russian history after those slave raids of the Vikings in the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries?
Yeah, our story really starts with Rurik, a character called Rurik, semi-mythic. We know virtually nothing about him. We know virtually nothing about this period. And much of it may be made up by monks writing the primary chronicles, you know, 300 years after the events that take place. But basically, Rurik is a semi-legendary Varangian Viking Nordic man who comes down the rivers to trade with rowers, with armed forces, and ultimately these people, these Varangians, these Vikings, would merge somehow with the Slavic people who were also moving into this area. And it's a process we don't understand. We don't know all about it. But we do know...
Is it sort of slavers and enslaved coming together, or is it...
No, they're trading in furs, they're trading in slaves. Slaves, I mean, the one thing when you read the world of family history is that you realise that slavery is like an omnipresent part of all societies until the mid-19th century. And so they were trading slaves. The word slave comes from Slav, and Slavic slaves, blonde slaves, were sold throughout Europe in millions, and the slave trade, which we'll come to later, because, you know, part of our story in Ivan the Terrible includes one of the biggest slave trading expeditions ever in 1572, when they captured 150,000 slaves, apparently.
We're going to come to Ivan the Terrible, but I want to sort of start and use a pivot point in another Ivan the Great, because he is this crossroads between the Mongols, basically in the 13th century, coming and doing their frequent smash and grabs in territory that you've described. And then this man comes along and says, right, like Gandalf, you will not pass. Tell us about the lesser known Ivan.
And he's already based in Moscow. Muscovy is the centre.
I think just to sort of literally just to do this very in a very short way, Rurik comes down the rivers. He settles in places like Novgorod. In 862, you know, he founds a dynasty, the Rurikid dynasty, that ruled Russia until 1598. So all the people we're going to be talking about in the first part of this are the descendants of Rurik. His family takes Kiev, and in 988, his descendant, Vladimir the Great, converts to Orthodox Christianity from paganism, sponsored by Basil, the Bulgar Slayer, the Byzantine, the Eastern Roman Emperor. From now on, these rulers and their people are Orthodox Christians, and the family rules these kingdoms united for a very short time. Then they break up and different princes in the family rule different cities. You know, there's Vladimir is the biggest, Vladimir Suzdal, there's Kiev, and of course, there's Moscow. So this is where Moscow comes in. In 1147, Moscow is first mentioned. It's founded by one of these Rurikid princes, Yuri Dolgoruki, the long arm. He's an interesting character because when they found Moscow in 1147, as English listeners will know, it's just after 1066 in the Norman conquest. His mother is Harald Godwinson's daughter.
This is our Harald, yeah. Not Harald Hardrada.
Yeah, this is our Harald who's killed at the Battle of Hastings. His daughter, Gaitha, probably is the mother of the founder of Moscow, which is quite a thought. So there's a very good English Anglo-Saxon connection there. So that's where Moscow becomes important. And one line of the family rules Moscow, the Principality of Moscow. And as we go through history, Moscow becomes the most important of these principalities, not Kiev, not Novgorod, and so on. And ultimately, we then jump to 1223, when the Mongols invade Russia. They slaughter and defeat the Russian princes, the Rurikid princes, in 1223. And then they come back in 1238, and they conquer all. They defeat all the Russian Rurikid princes. And for the next 200 years, the Rurikid princes, the great princes of Moscow, are literally just sort of henchmen of the Khans, who rule from Karakorum in Outer Mongolia at first, and then the Golden Horde, the descendants of Genghis Khan, who rule from Sarai, their capital. And quite often, these Rurikid princes are invited out to Sarai and murdered there, and somebody else is appointed Prince of Moscow.
And the Golden Horde have converted to Islam by this stage, or are they still...
Yes, they have. Over time, they start off as worshippers of great golden sky and
Altai.
Golden heaven, all that. And then they convert to Islam. And so by the time that Anita is talking, the time of the Ivan I, Ivan II, Ivan III, they are Muslim. They have themselves broken up into many smaller khanates. The Golden Horde is the biggest, and it rules basically Russia. And so gradually, the Moscow princes become very rich as fundraisers, as tax collectors, and as general sort of thugs on behalf of the Golden Horde Khans. But also, they dream of freeing themselves from the Mongol yoke.
Yeah, so I mean, they're getting stronger and richer, and it seems to me sort of biding their time. But at the same time, are the Mongols getting weaker and weaker? And and that's very important, isn't it?
Yes, for 100 years, the Mongols are all powerful, even when they break up into different empires. So there's the Ilkhans ruling what is now Persia, Iraq, and there's the Golden Horde ruling Russia, for example, and there's Kublai Khan and his family ruling China. So there's this, the great empire is still very powerful. But as time goes on, after about 100 years, they start to fall apart and they start to weaken. And in 1380, Dmitry Donskoy, one of the princes of Moscow, actually defeats the Mongols, who are also known, just to be complicated, as the Tatars.
Right.
They defeat the Mongols at Kulikovo, and that is the sort of first great victory that they win. But it's 100 years before they really get rid of the Golden Horde.
But what is the reason for the Mongol decline is what exactly? They just, you know, they peter out as empires do peter out, or, you know, you have a new generation that's not interested. You know, the clogs to clogs theory of, you know, people forget what brought them there. What is it?
Well, they last 200 years, and the last of the sort of the Genghis Khan family is still ruling in Bukhara in 1922.
Yeah.
And an offshoot of them is Tamerlane, which, you know, who we'll come to in a second, whose family goes on to rule India as the Mughals, which again connects up with a wonderful podcast.
Upcoming series of Empire, yes. Pod, most definitely.
Well, Tamerlane's a fascinating character. But I think we should jump ahead now. So to 1380 is the date that you know, is the beginning of the freeing of Russia, of Moscow, from the Mongol yoke. He defeats a Mongol Khan, but within about 2 years, the Mongols are back, and it's a totally exaggerated date. And, you know, Tamerlane ravages Russia in the late 1390s, and the Mongol horde again demands the payment of tribute from Moscow. And you've got to realise, by the way, Russia doesn't exist yet. This is Moscow. There was called the Great Princes of Moscow, and Veliki Knyaz Moskovsky, and they, that's the state that exists now. Russia is a later invention, which we're going to come to. But another reason why the Mongols actually now have a sort of eclipse in Russia is the rise of another power, which is the combination of Poland and Lithuania, which is a vast state that at its height rules from the Baltic to the Black Sea. And that challenges them. And Moscow is somewhere in between these two very powerful states, neither of which exist anymore. So there are lots of countries we're going to talk about in this conversation that don't exist today.
I want to focus in, though, on the one character, the lesser-known Ivan, the great, not the terrible. So what was he like, and who was he, and, you know, what made him special?
He's a fascinating character. He's one of the giants of Russian history. He's an extraordinarily opportunistic, ruthless, brilliant visionary.
I can see your face lighting up as you contemplate him.
Yes, I mean, he has an incredibly tragic childhood. His father is Vasily II, Vasily the Blind, who faces a 25-year family feud. And in the process of this, Vasily is blinded, a terrible thing at any time, but obviously in a time when rulers were expected to rule, to lead their armies of battle. And his son, little Ivan, is captured and is imprisoned as a boy of 8, away from his parents. So he has this traumatic... a traumatic childhood for a ruler always instills a respect for power, a sense of paranoid vigilant security, and a will to control and to expand and to dominate.
We see this later, don't we, with Peter the Great and so on.
I mean, it's that Mark Twain quote, history doesn't repeat itself, but it all rhymes. And in Russia, there are so many, I mean, throughout history, yes, traumatized, terrified little boys who grow up to be extraordinarily either awful or just mostly awful, you know, leaders in their own right.
Yeah, we should talk about, I mean, psychologically, that's of course true, Anita, but also there are echoes today, and that was something we should probably talk about at some point and just mention, is that the Russian state has no borders, has no natural borders. It's a vast Eurasian plain, which means that Russia, of course, can expand easily in all directions. But it also means it's always insecure. Its rulers always have a military duty, more so than any other kingdom in Europe. And it also has two key influences. We mentioned already the Byzantine connection, and Orthodox Christianity, you know, was led by the emperor and the patriarch in Byzantium, in Constantinople, the Eastern Roman Empire. But in 1453, that vanishes, that falls to the Ottomans. And that's exactly the period that we're now talking about.
So this is the sad demise of the Palaiologos. But then Ivan sort of says, right, well, I'm the man. And he steps forward and he says, right, I'm the head now of the Orthodox Church. He fills that vacuum.
Well, this happens with a marriage, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, the other half of this, which I think is much more important, the Russians always emphasise this Byzantine. And Ivan the Great, who we're talking about now, he emphasised it. He said, you know, the first Rome has fallen, the second Rome has fallen, now we are the third Rome, we will be the centre of the Orthodox world, and I will be the Caesar. And he uses the word Tsar. And this is where the beginning of he's the first to really use the word Tsar.
In case anyone didn't pick that up, Tsar and Caesar are the same word.
Yeah. And later in German, Kaiser. But this is where he says, we are an emperor, this is an empire, and I am the Caesar, the Tsar. A much more important influence on Russia, which is not mentioned in Russian history, it was mentioned much less, is of course that really these Tsars, these princes of Moscow, are semi-Tartars. They're semi-Mongols. Their army is a cavalry, mainly a cavalry force with bows and arrows and crossbows, exactly like Tartars. Many of their soldiers are Tartar renegades. Much of their court is made up of Tartar princes that they call Tsareviches, which are sort of sons of kings, sons of emperors, who are descendants of Genghis Khan, who convert to Christianity and marry into the aristocracy there.
So he takes on this notion that he is the first Caesar, you know, the first Caesar, but also the inheritor of the orthodoxy, that he's going to defend it, even though he has this mixed bag of troops that are supporting him, which is irony upon irony.
And tell us about his wife. Tell us about Sophie Palaiologos and this extraordinary princess.
What he does is he marries Sophie Palaiologa, who is, in fact, whose real name is Zoe in the Greek, who's been brought up in Rome, and she is the niece of Constantine XI, Palaiologos, the last emperor of Constantinople, who dies and vanishes. His body is never found in the ruins of Constantinople.
On the walls, battling
yeah, they just
to the
find
end.
His, they yeah. find his shoes, isn't it? Right, the tragic story the of his shoes, the slippers turning up.
Do
yeah.
they, do they? I mean, they yeah. never find him. He takes off his insignia and throws himself into battle. And so she has been brought up.
She's the niece, right?
She's the niece. She's been brought up in Rome. And the Pope kind of sponsors this strange marriage because it's an sponsors this Orthodox espousal. She comes to Moscow. And even though we don't know everything about her, and some we may be exaggerating her importance given the fashion for exaggerating or promoting women in history, which is very important. She's clearly an incredibly able, interesting, intelligent player in the politics of this place where she's arriving from the heart of civilization, Rome. She's going to Moscow, to Muscovy, this kind of brutal and complex world that she knows nothing about. And she makes a success of it. And she brings much with her. What exactly she does, we don't know. But she's certainly influential in things like Ivan decides to improve the Kremlin, the sort of 69-acre kind of castle, which is the centre of Moscow and still is, of course. And so thanks to her influence, they go to the Medicis and they bring over a whole lot of Italian, Florentine and Roman craftsmen and architects to improve and rebuild this kind of and embellish the Kremlin.
So those red crenellated walls that you see now when you go to the Kremlin, that is a gift of Ivan and his missus. I mean, that is
their thing. And the funny thing is we think of them now as typically Russian, those walls. But in fact, they were typically Renaissance. This is the Renaissance that comes to Moscow and they build things. They rebuild the Dormition Cathedral where all czars are crowned for the rest of Russian history.
And Sebag, this is to mark the defeat on the River Ugra of Ahmed Khan, the last of the Mongols to really threaten Muscovy.
Well, what's interesting about it, Ahmed Khan is one of these Genghisid princes, as you say, one of these Genghisid Khans. He marches an army into Russia, into Muscovy, and Ivan the Great goes out with his army, and they sit at the Ugra, and they sit there, and in the end, nothing happens. So it's a battle that never takes place. But Ahmed Khan just retreats and goes off back onto the steppe. And yes, and of course, this is a key moment, because at last, you know, the shoe is now on the other foot. The worm has turned and Muscovy is now a rising power under this extraordinary person. One of the fascinating things about Ivan the Great is he's also known as Grozny.
Grozny is the terrible. Yeah.
He is the terrible, the grim. And the stern. He looks very like his grandson, Ivan the Terrible.
They're not portrayed smiling very often in their portraits.
And just to finish Ivan the Great, Ivan the Third, you know, he adds many, many of the other Rurikid cities and kingdoms to Muscovy. And it's now that Muscovy becomes a huge empire. It's massive. It becomes enormous. And they add places like Yaroslav, Rostov, Vyatka, and the most importantly, the Republic of Novgorod, which is a sort of semi-democratic oligarchical republic, and which is a sort of state that shows there could have been another destiny for Russian politics, which is very interesting. So by the time he dies, he's added massively, and now Muscovy, as the English called it at the time, is now a massive state with all of these countries. His son adds to it. His son Vasily III adds to the empire, but dies very young. And when he dies, his son Ivan IV, Ivan the Terrible, is 3 years old. And he succeeds to the throne, becomes Grand Prince of Muscovy.
Well, let's just hold that thought for 1 second. It's a good time to take a break. Join us after the break for more with Simon Sebag Montefiore. Welcome back. Let's talk about expansion, and we're going to leap from one Ivan to the other. Ivan the Terrible, no, poor old the Great is forgotten in favour of the Terrible, who's so much more memorable. Is he terrible from the start? Why? I mean, when does he get that moniker? Does it come from the people? Does it come from himself?
I mean, from the beginning, he's an incredibly impressive character, Anita. He's tall, he's striking, he's described as very like his grandfather, who we've been discussing.
Can I read your description from it? Because it was like, it's almost like somebody would write if they had a crush on someone, forgive me, but you know, I can imagine that. Lithe as a leopard, with an aquiline nose, a sensual mouth and flashing eyes. I'm adding this line, he's dreamy. But are there many people who comment on his beauty at the time? Is that a big deal?
And yet things are about to go so horribly wrong.
He's so pretty, but he's so pretty awful. Yeah.
So in 1533, Henry VIII is king of England. Ivan, as a little boy, succeeds to the throne as a boy as a tiny boy. And his mother rules, Elena Glinskaya rules for a while, but she dies when he's about eight. And she's probably poisoned or possibly poisoned. And they've looked at, there's a lot of poison in this story, and they've looked at her body. And there is a lot of poison in the body.
Did they use arsenic, lead? I mean, what was the poison of choice?
Yeah, I can't remember which the poison is, but they checked the poisons.
Poison of choice.
Poison of choice. And the doctors sort of, you know, were basically prescribing such poisonous medicines that it's impossible to tell if she's been poisoned. But later on in Ivan's reign, we find people whose bodies actually show they have been poisoned. So he succeeds to the throne as a child. He feels ignored. He runs around the Kremlin with a bunch of friends. He's said to torture animals, but, you know, that people normally describe later monsters as doing that in their childhood. But what does happen is powerful families dominate the Kremlin. He feels neglected and disrespected. He feels that the Tsar, the great prince, is a sacred figure. And as he grows up, his mother dies, he's on his own, and he grows up insecure, ambitious, a sense of melodrama about himself, a sense of theatricality, but also a sense that he is special, he is sacred. He is the sacred ruler destined to make the empire greater. And he grows up hating the interconnected baronial families, the boyars, as they're called, the boyar families. When he's a little old, when he comes of age, he is crowned in the Dormition Cathedral, the first to be crowned as Tsar of Muscovy. And I mean, that is an amazing moment, because this is the first sense when someone is crowned Tsar.
Yeah, I just also, again, you know, this sort of is important, because if you are feeling that much under threat, and if you do think that, you know, people around you are being poisoned, what you want is your own close Praetorian guard. And he does that. He has basically a bunch of thugs around him as henchmen to do, you know, the protecting. I love the fact that their insignia shows their loyalty. What was it again? It was a dog and a broom. Is that right?
Well, we're coming to that in a second, because that is exactly right. That's the Oprichniki, and that is a fascinating and important part of it. So just very, very quick, because I know we want to get to that stuff. Ivan is at first incredibly successful. He marries successfully. He loves his wife. She's Anastasia Romanovna, and she is the first.
She's the first Romanov.
And he's incredibly happy with her. He has children with her, and many children die, but some sons succeed. And the eldest son, Ivan, also called Little Ivan, is healthy and fit to rule. But as you can imagine, it's a hard thing to have Ivan the Terrible as a father. But we'll come to that in a second. So, you know, everything goes well. And his first job, we talked about the Mongols. We talked about how the Mongol influence on the Mongol Khan ruled every bit of land in the state. And all of even the great landowners and generals were slaves. Ivan the Terrible believes that, too. And this is a part. Mongol influence on the Russian autocracy is enormous and much greater than is normally given credit for, especially in Russian history, who want to promote the Byzantine connection. So he's growing up in this court. He's now Tsar. He's a young man in his teens, and he wants to continue the conquest that his grandfather began, Ivan the Great. So he raises an army. He creates the first artillery. He brings in musketeers, people who use muskets, in other words, instead of bows and arrows.
And this is quite early days of muskets. This is cutting-edge technology.
It is. This is cutting-edge technology. He brings in lots of German and other Europeans to improve his armed forces. He creates an artillery, and he marches down to attack two of the great khanates, the Mongol khanates of the south. And he takes Kazan and great
time. Kazan and then Astrakhan.
And Astrakhan. And he takes those two khanates. He conquers them. He massacres everybody down there.
I mean, is that par for the course? Do you always massacre everyone you conquer? Or is this particularly...
No, because many of the family, many of these Genghisid princes, these Tsarevich, as they call them, join the court. And one has to, when one looks at the court of Ivan the Terrible, it's a semi-Mongol court, you know. And remember, Mongols are very different. They look different. They sound different. They convert to Christianity and they adopt names. So the Yusupov family, you know, the one who murdered Rasputin in 1916, you know, that comes from the word Yusuf. Yusupov.
Wow. I never connected
many
that
of the, many of those great families are called Cherkassky. That means they're royalty from, you know, from Circassia in the south. So many of his enforcers, many of his generals are in fact descended from Mongols. Anyway, he's incredibly successful. He comes back to Moscow and to celebrate, he builds St. Basil's glorious cathedral in Red Square. But at the same time, bad stuff begins to happen. There are many fires in Moscow. Straight after his coronation in 1547, Henry VIII has just died, of course. There's a huge fire in Moscow. There's a riot. There's a rebellion. And the sense of fires burning all the time is a sort of plays into his insecurity, his paranoia, his increasingly strange mentality. In 1553, he has a mysterious illness. He very nearly dies. And as he teeters on the edge of death, everyone refuses to swear allegiance to his baby son, Ivan, whose mother is the Romanov. Mm. And instead, they tend to acclaim his cousin, Prince Vladimir of Starosti, who is an adult. And when he suddenly wakes up after this, he finds out this is the case. First of all, he's not right in the head.
He doesn't take this lying down.
He gets up and he basically sees this as a trial of the elite's loyalty. And from now on, he distrusts everybody.
You have a very nice paragraph in your Romanov book when you outline the different ways he deals with his unfaithful boyars. And you mentioned beating, strangling, sewing into bearskins is a good one, and throwing to starving hunting dogs, or
That's cooked alive
in burning stoves.
Could you, I mean, just at the risk of repelling everybody, but we'll do it anyway, what does sewing into a bearskin do to a person?
It's extremely uncomfortable, first of all. but the real point is it means that dogs think you're a bear and attack you.
I see, and then you get ripped apart.
Okay. He also very much favours crazy stuff. But let me just jump a second. In 1558... He launches a massive war. So he succeeded in the south. He's still an amazing success. He's very young still. He's in his 20s. And he launches the Livonian War. And the idea of this is to take from Poland, Lithuania, the Baltic Sea. Livonia is the Baltic states. Livonia, you know, Lithuania, Estonia and Latvia.
What's the distance between there and Moscow? I mean, what kind of area are we talking of his conquest?
Well, many hundreds of miles away. He marches there and he starts off by having great successes, but the war expands exponentially. What he wanted as a regional war, just to get Poland, to get Livonia, explodes into this huge regional war, which takes 20 years. And though he has some successes, he also has some disasters and it begins to go wrong. And this is when he begins to distrust everybody. Many of his boyars start to defect to the Poles, and everybody, Sweden, Lithuania, Polish Lithuania, the Teutonic Knights, all of them join in. And this leads to a disaster. By the 1560s, a whole lot of things start to go very, very wrong. In 1560, his beloved wife Anastasia dies. He suspects poison, of course. Probably isn't poison. It's probably that he's been dragging her around on his crazy pilgrimages as she's pregnant. And anyway, she dies. He distrusts everybody. And now he decides to launch an insane project, which is the beginning of his madness, Anita. And this is what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. He decides to divide up the kingdom. He says, Moscow, I can't trust you. He says to the boyars, I'm going to divide up the kingdom. And the Zemchina, the main part of the land in Moscow, will be ruled by a council that I appoint. But I'm going to go out to a regional country house, and I'm going to rule from there, and I'm going to create a state within a state. And this state is the Oprichnina, and he creates this elite group of henchmen, the Oprichniki.
These are the dogs and brooms guys, yes, that I was so taken with.
They wear all black. They are heavily armed with swords and muskets. They wear black. They have a dog's head and a broom on their saddle. And they are the Avengers. And of course, your sharp historical listeners will know that this is very like the NKVD or the elite mm-hmm. KGB or the FSB in Russia, in modern Russian history, an elite group of knights who are avengers of the state to crush all disloyalty and all traitors and to kill them all. And now he launches all his, I would say Baroque almost, method, complex.
Well, you're not kidding. I mean, there's there's gouging, there's roping women and children together and throwing them under ice. There's
inserting hooks in ribs and hanging people. Yeah.
He's very into the rib thing. Now, this is an obsession of his. He's very into the rib thing, where he you hook through the ribs a hook into the body, and then you hang people by it. Mm. But he hunts down the elites. But of course, oftentimes he's not a complete fool, and there is method in his madness. He hunts down anyone who could have a different loyalties. He wipes out whole clans who are loyal to each other and, of course, can avenge each other. But, of course, it also leads to lots of people, more people defecting. He holds extravagant ceremonies of mass murder.
You have a scene where you arrive at a field and there are kind pots of boiling water, hooks lined up and all his instruments of torture.
Yeah. In 1570, they have this kind of Oprichniki sort of orgy of death outside, the pagan field outside Moscow, and hundreds of gallows and vats of boiling water and boiling oil are there, and all the Moscovites come out to watch, and many of them are killed personally, and he's killing his elite, he's killing his former foreign minister. He's calling all his ministers are murdered out there in this orgy of killing. And he also loves blowing people up. One of the things he does is gallops into someone's estate, puts them all in a house, fills it with gunpowder, and then lights the light and gallops off, and then shout Yahoo! And Hoda is his great cry, as the bits of body blow up into the sky. Meanwhile, in his headquarters, it's a mixture between a sort of the Playboy mansion and an extremely ascetic, austere monastery.
That's a complicated mixture.
It's a design choice, but
he goes to prayers. Everyone wears, everyone shaves their heads. Everyone goes to prayers, and anyone who doesn't turn up in prayers is in big trouble. But at the same time, he's having orgies with courtesans and prostitutes. He's having gay affairs.
At the same time? I mean,
yes, it's almost on the same, you know, almost on the same day.
The morning is given over to asceticism, then it's playboy after the afternoons. Or
And of course, the more he kills, the more strangely behaves. In a way, this adds to the mystique, his mystique. Mm. And he has a big gay love affair with Fyodor Basmanov. And that's also, of course, extremely scandalous in a very, very orthodox community. And, you know, at this time, in 1567, the English have now arrived and are trading heavily with this great...
The Muscovy Company, who we've dealt with earlier.
The Muscovy Company, which you know about.
The first chartered company, the first corporation.
And at this point, he feels out Elizabeth I to see if she'd accept him if he lost the throne. So he's constantly thinking about losing the throne. In 1570, as well as the massacre at the pagan field outside Moscow that William mentioned... he also attacks Novgorod, which is always had an independent esprit, and he attacks it. He massacres thousands of people there. He pushes half the population under the ice, as Anita mentioned. He ties together men and women and children and pushes them under the ice. He loves drowning people under
the
ice.
He's a psycho. He's an utter psycho.
He is now, I think you can say, semi-insane, yes.
Semi?
A key thing happens in 1571 and 1572, which is that the Devlet Khan, the Giray Khan of what I mentioned, this massive power. To give you an idea of how strong the Khanate of Krim Tartary or the Crimean Tartars are, they amass now an army of 150,000 horsemen.
That's a big army.
So it's very powerful. You know, this is not really a middling European power. This is a major European power. And they take advantage of the chaos that Ivan the Terrible has partly caused, and they gallop up and they actually take the capital, Moscow, in 1572. They take the capital, they burn it, and they leave with 150. They're supposed to have killed 80,000 people, and they're supposed to have left with 150,000 slaves, which they then take down. The biggest slave trade in the world at this time. The slave trade across the Atlantic is already started and is taking, you know, is a huge business. At the same time, this is another one. This is the other great slave trade. And it's a slave trade that over time may have enslaved 10 million people. But at this point, they leave with 150,000.
I think the figure they always give for the transatlantic slave trade is 12 million.
Yeah, 12 million. And this is something like 10 million. And it's colossal. And what they do is these people are all sold in the Crimea, where the greatest slave market in Europe takes place at Kaffa, in the Crimea. And that slave trade is enormous. And later the Ottomans take it over, and it funds much of the expansion of Suleiman the Magnificent and all of that, which is taking place at the same time. So the Ottomans have a share, if you like, in the empire of their, in the state of their allies, the Crimean Tartars. So they burn Moscow, they gallop away, and Ivan the Terrible realizes he screwed up. This dividing of the thing, the war in Livonia, it's all screwed up. He comes back, takes power, kills all the oprichniki, rather like Stalin was to kill his secret police chiefs, Yagoda and Yezhov, and he comes back to power and he does what he can to try and improve try and rescue what he's lost. So he launches another reign of terror. One of the people he kills in this later reign of terror is a fascinating character, Dr. Eliezer Bomelius, who is his German, well, let's say he's a German poisoner and sort of a hierophant who has been in London, the London, Elizabethan London. And he's been advising Ivan the Terrible who to kill and giving him poisons to kill them with. Because Ivan, by this point, has killed all his cousins, all his Rurikid cousins, the princes, Prince Vladimir of Starostia. He's poisoned them with cyanide and an arsenic. And so, and their bodies have
secretly
been...
Secretly or in a kind of showy way with, like, the gallows?
Openly. He strangled the patriarch, the Metropolitan of Moscow.
I mean, he really is terrible. He is terrible.
And then in 1575, a really extraordinary thing happens. He's told by one of his wizards, one of his hierophants, that the Tsar is about to die, is going to die on the throne. So he abdicates the throne and places on it a Mongol prince.
Because if someone's going to die, it's going to be him. Yeah. That's his thinking.
So right. In October 1575, he puts Simeon Bekbulatovich, who is a converted Mongol, he puts him on the throne and he rules for a year and then he takes it back again. But nothing happens to Simeon. He remains a great grandee. Something fascinating, that this is the Empire podcast. In the 1550s, Ivan has done something which is to have enormous significance. He's given the Stroganov family, a powerful family of traders, he's given them the right to expand across the Urals. Up to now, Muscovy, Russia, this early Russian version of the Russian Empire, only goes up to the Urals. Now the Stroganov family start to build forts and to create their own private army and to expand into Siberia.
Is this a sort of parallel to the Muscovy Company and the East India Company and merchant capitalism?
Yes. And so merchant capitalism is not only an English thing. I mean, the Stroganovs are exactly the same thing as a sort of, they have their own army, they have their own fortresses, and they start to expand, and they are fur trading, and they are trading in minerals, and they start to expand, and it happens incredibly quickly. Before you know it, they have hired a kind of Clive of India type, Yermak the Cossack, and he has defeated, in the early 1780s, he defeats the Kuchum, the Khan of Sibir, which is a country, a khanate, and they've taken Siberia, basically. And now Muscovy, Russia is expanding across Siberia, heading for the Pacific.
So what happens to the succession? Ivan seems so very terrible. He seems to be slaughtering everybody and anybody. I mean, is there a peaceful transition of power? What happens?
No, he destroys everything he's built. His son and heir is Ivan, healthy and ready to rule. But Ivan suddenly starts screaming at his daughter-in-law and saying she's not wearing the right religious clothing. She's not covering up enough as she's pregnant. And his son attacks him and criticizes him, not attacks him physically. And Ivan turns on him with the staff of Tsardom, which is a pointed metal staff, and strikes him through the head and kills his heir there and then.
You have a nice passage, Sebag, where you write that he denounces himself. Ivan says, "I am a sinner, a stinking hound, always wallowing in drunkenness, fornication, adultery, filth, murders, rapine, dispellation, depoination, hatred, yes, and all sorts of evil doing."
It's all true. He's heartbroken, but his daughter-in-law also loses the baby now, and she miscarries. In 1584,
this is not a happy story.
He dies naturally, and he's succeeded by his weak younger son, who is simple of mind, unhealthy, and he's called Fyodor the Bellringer because he's so religious, and so he ruins the kingdom basically.
Okay, now we're going to again do the time travel thing, because we're sort of hopscotching from the people that we've found most utterly historical and also important in this foundation of Russia. You gave us a glimpse of a Romanov with Anastasia marrying into this crazy family. But you have Michael Romanov to 1613. I'd love us to go there.
Yes.
And his accession to this, you know, nutty establishment of filled with blood, gore, and intrigue.
I feel that, Anita, we've been outgored and out.
Oh God, totally. We are totally.
And out, all our people in Kohinoor, we thought were the most bloodthirsty in history. You know,
we were a children's program compared
sort of
to this.
World Wildlife Fund sort of fox savers. And
no, it's ridiculous.
We're jumping sort of almost 20 years now, but let's do that. What happens in the interim is that the great principality of Moscow breaks up. It becomes a failed state. It's invaded by everybody. The Tartars, the Swedes, the Poles, they even take Moscow. Russia's ruled by crazy imposters called the False Dmitries. And there are three False Dmitries. And the third False Dmitry is the baby brigand. And he ends up in 1613 hanged, aged three, from the battlements of Moscow. And now everybody realizes that Russia is about to cease to exist, and they look for a pure young king to restore the kingdom. And the person that they all turn to is a boy, a teenage boy, who is the first cousin once removed of Fyodor the Bellringer, in other words, the son of Ivan the Terrible, and who is the great nephew-in-law of Ivan the Terrible. So he's the last person with a real connection to the old dynasty. And the old dynasty is finished. After 1598, there are no more Rurik kids. But there's this boy. And this boy is being hunted by Swedish and Polish assassins. And he's hiding at Kostroma, north of Moscow,
with
in a monastery.
Mum.
With his mum, the nun Martha.
Yes, well, yes, quite the nun Martha, yeah.
And they don't, his father, Filaret, who's also been forced to take the tonsure of monk, is in a Polish prison. And they arrive at Kostroma and they offer him the throne. And three times, him and his mother sob and refuse the throne.
It's even better than that. In my head, it is Monty Python. It is, he is not the Tsar. He's a very naughty boy. Bugger off. We don't want this. I mean, that's what it feels like to me.
They're at the Ipatiev Monastery. It's the 13th of March, 1613. They beg him to accept it. And on the third time, he goes, okay, I'll be Tsar. But you've got to realise, it's not a very attractive offer at this point.
You could say.
You've made that point quite conclusive.
You might say. It's not the best gig in town. Mm.
The Kremlin is literally, it's literally a charnel house. The Kremlin is ruined. There's no silver, there's no gold, there's no palace, and there are bodies everywhere. It's been ruled by the Poles. But Michael Romanov, who's very young, agrees. They march back to Moscow and they establish a new dynasty, the Romanov dynasty. And Michael is the first Romanov Tsar.
And that dynasty lasts right up to 1917.
It lasts up until 1917. And though we think of it as a cursed dynasty, it is the most successful family of modern times.
And this, as Empire Podcast, you write the most successful imperialist family.
The most successful imperialist family. And it's an empire that we constantly underrate, we constantly neglect. We're very obsessed with our own empire and we forget this is the real thing.
Well, look, it's a great place to leave this, and we will begin our next episode of Empire with the Romanoffs. So delightful.
A barnstormer, Seabag. Yeah. A barnstormer.
Okay.
Join us then for the legacy of Michael the First Romanoff and what happens next. There'll be greats in there. Not so many terribles, but, you know, greats can be terrible too. But join us on Thursday. That's it from me, Anita Arnon.
And me, William Durimple.